Everything we do is music.
Acoustic space. Boundless, directionless, horizonless.
36.
20.
20. Welcome to 3620, podcasting from the basement of 3620 Walnut Street, by the doctoral students at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Pennsylvania. I'm your host, Deborah Loy, and today we bring you a piece by Kevin Godkin called The Afterlives of Our Words. Hope you enjoy.
Isn't it odd to think that right now, someone thousands of miles away from you might be reading an essay you wrote? Maybe you wrote it as you picked at your fingernails and bit your lip, and wrote and rewrote and rewrote one sentence. And then later, you're totally unaware when that sentence is literally in the palm of someone else's hand. There's a reader somewhere who might be engaging in the most sensitive and primordial way with your words, reading you. At that precise moment, the most exciting intellectual communion there is, you're buying toilet paper or checking your junk email, or trying to get the dust out from your keyboard's crevices. Isn't that weird? There seems to be a whole hidden afterlife to the words we write. We send them on their way, and like toys in the night, they come alive when you're not looking.
I'm Barbie Zelizer, and I'm the Raymond Williams Professor of Communication here at the Annenberg School.
If you know the work of Barbie Zelizer, then you know she's interested in how we remember things, how journalists add to and delete from the tribe's collective scroll. And she's interested in how the academy makes memories, too, how knowledge becomes knowledge. So maybe, then, it's not surprising that she's the perfect person to talk to about the afterlives of our research, when and how our work gets remembered. I sat down with her to ask about some moments from her own career when this afterlife becomes suddenly, unexpectedly visible.
Probably my favorite story of this goes all the way back to my dissertation, which was the beginning draft of what became Covering the Body, my book on the American news media and the John F. Kennedy assassination. And, you know, the whole time that I was writing that book, I was focused on this population that was beyond the academy, beyond the population of journalists, and had come to be known pretty generally as assassination buffs.
You could also call them conspiracy theorists.
And these were the folks who had literally left their careers, left their professions, often left their families in order to devote themselves to this obsession with who killed Kennedy.
There were the single bullet theorists, or the body manipulation aboard Air Force One theorists, or the autopsy picture theorists. These are the folks most interested in the writing about the assassination, but also the folks you're most worried about reading it.
And every time I'd give a talk, I would always be afraid that somewhere in the back of the room, there would be that one person who would raise his hand or her hand at the end of my lecture and ask me the question that I couldn't answer about exactly the intricacy that they knew so well about and that I looked at as some level of conspiracy theory. Did I really need to go into this as much as they would have expected me to?
These people embodied the question that academics labor over with every project. Where do we stop? When do we cut the network of all the related pieces of this puzzle? Well, Professor Zelizer cuts her network. She finishes the dissertation, turns it into a book, and submits it to the University of Chicago Press.
It went through review, came through. My editor calls me from University of Chicago Press and says, Barbie, Reviews are great. We're ready to go, but we have one problem. And I said, what's the one problem? And he said, remember what you told me about every time you talk about this, and you're always afraid that there's a conspiracy buff or an assassination buff or a conspiracy theorist somewhere in the back of the room? Well, bingo. He had taken it to the board at the University of Chicago Press, and on the board, one of the faculty on the board of the Chicago University of Chicago Press was a conspiracy theorist who said he did not want this book to go out under the signature of the University of Chicago Press unless I seriously considered all the conspiracy theory literature.
In a few days, a hulking box arrives on her porch, full of all the books on the assassination from the last 30 years, many of them out-of-print paperbacks that were critical of the mainstream media's take on the assassination.
So that was a lesson to me. It was a really important lesson moving forward because it said to me, you know, you think you're done, you're never done, A. And B, you always need to go to the margins of the groups that you think matter to really make them matter. And I think that in the end, my argument about the mainstream media became that much more acute, that much more critical, that much better, that much more resonant with what was going on in the culture than would have been the case to begin with.
Years later, Professor Zelizer finished another book called Remembering to Forget, about photography, memory, and the Holocaust. And in that review process, Professor Zelizer realized how quickly the publishing cycle moves from being intensely concerned about your argument into a kind of administrative routine.
You know, you deliver your book over to your publisher, and there it goes. It goes into this process, you know, whereby people who don't give a whit about your argument are taking very important decisions about what gets displayed and what gets pushed and what gets pulled back and what gets minimized. And it's, you kind of fall out of their attention span when the process, as with any factory process, moves to a different stage in its implementation.
And so after Remembering to Forget has been printed and she's starting to move on to another project, she gets a frantic phone call out of the blue. It's from the Museum of Tolerance in Los Angeles.
And this is one of the big centers for the study of genocide, Holocaust. And they were frantic because they hadn't heard from me. And I called them back and I said, I'm really sorry. I don't know who you, I mean, I know who you are, but I don't know why you're calling me. And they said, well, you got the Tolerance Prize for Remembering to Forget. And we are holding a reception in your honor at the Rittenhouse Hotel on X and X date. And we don't even know if you know about it. And I said, I don't know about it. And they said, well, we contacted your editor at the University of Chicago Press months ago, and he was supposed to have let you know.
It was lucky that she was going to be in town then, because people were flying in from L.A. The judges were going to be there, and they were expecting her to invite the people she wanted to celebrate with on her own turf. The phone call came just days before the reception.
And of course, I had no time to do anything. I called my editor and I said, hey, like, what? You know, like, did you know this? He said, oh, yeah, I forgot to tell you. So that was my first big award, book award. It was a doozy. I mean, it got recuperated at the very last moment. I think I pulled in my neighbors. I pulled in whoever I could. Just please come. I mean, I felt so bad. You know, it was champagne and there were hors d'oeuvres and I had nobody there because I didn't have time to get it on anybody's schedule. But at least I made it.
It turns out that the people most essential in connecting us to our readers, the people watching our pages be printed, are also dealing with other authors whose books are just as central to their lives, too, who might also be winning awards. Accolades matter to some for some moment, Professor Zelizer says, but they're not the most important thing in the world. For that, she says, you have to think about the people you're writing about. Part of the argument when she was writing about the JFK assassination was that the story of Kennedy's death became a story about the American news media that actively kept the event alive in various ways.
This was, of course, this is a reference to CBS, and it's particularly a reference to Dan Rather, who made a whole industry out of his own post-reflections about what it meant for him to cover the assassination of John F. Kennedy.
CBS made great hay of the claim that Rather was the first to report on air of Kennedy's death, and for years he was the centerpiece of CBS's retrospectives on the assassination.
And of course, one of the things I argue in the book is that this is a story that those who had the largest voice were able to create the largest tale. And those who had the smallest voice kind of disappeared from the retelling and collective memory. And one of the dimensions that disappeared was local media. That absolutely, it's like local media didn't even exist in the Kennedy assassination story.
And so one day, she gets a letter in the mail.
From this guy in Texas by the name of a reporter by the name of Eddie Barker, who was the person who had actually delivered to Dan Rather the story that Kennedy had died. And Eddie Barker said to me, dear Dr. Zelizer, I am so grateful that you have finally set this record straight. He said, I have been arguing with Dan Rather about this for years. I've been trying to get my name back into the story. It keeps getting eradicated. I'm truly appreciative of the fact that you were able to pull this out of the archival material and reinstate my presence in the story.
This, for Professor Zelizer, is huge.
And that meant everything, Kevin. That's like, oh yeah, yeah, you know? I mean, it's not just about getting it right, although of course there's a certain satisfaction in that, but it's about getting it right for something that matters, right? Dan Rather couldn't have covered that story without the local media, and to me, that was a real shameful eradication from the story.
This, I think, is an interesting suture between the academic and the practical heft of the book. Barker's career was put back into the story it was written out of, and at the same time, this letter crystallizes the larger point about the way that media structures can perpetuate one kind of retelling over another. What makes the story even more interesting is the crisscross afterlives at work. Professor Zelizer was writing about the afterlife of Dan Rather's broadcasts, and then in the afterlife of her writing, someone else comes to the fore about the way he is remembered. These afterlives are like thatched roofs that become the fabric of what we remember and what we know. Years after this happened, again with her book on the Holocaust, Professor Zelizer was giving a talk. It was a big talk, a large audience. She remembers standing at a podium.
And as I'm always wont to do, I was showing slides. And I showed, you know, I went through my slides, I went through my talk, and I got to the end of the discussion, and there was a Q&A. And this woman raised her hand, and she said, excuse me, could you go back to the slide, the first slide you showed us from Bergen-Belsen?
Many of the images in this talk were emblematic of what Professor Zelizer calls the Holocaust aesthetic, featuring people on the cusp of death, emaciated figures with vacant stares. In this particular photo, the woman asked to see again, there are two women peeling potatoes. Behind them, stacks of corpses.
And so it was an awful, awful juxtaposition of lived and dead in a way that I think brought home very much the true horror of what these images were hoping to convey and were designed to convey.
And so this woman stands up to ask a question. She's slight, probably in her 60s. She's near the back of the room.
And this woman says, looks at these two women, and she said, that's me. And I remember my heart stopped. I said, I think I said something like, come again? I thought I heard erroneously. And she said, that's me and my sister. And my sister died right after that photo was taken. And I remember when she spoke, I remember a kind of very trite phrase, but there's no better phrase. It was a deadening silence. There, nobody breathed. It was so unexpected. It was so profound. It was such a moment. It was such a kind of game changer that to this day, I still think about it, and my heart kind of drops.
Professor Zelizer says this is probably one of the most sobering moments of her academic career.
It humbles you in a way that you understand that no matter how, how can I say this, how ostensibly noble, how clean, how pure your motives might hope to be, this is always at some level using the personal tragedies of the people that these photos in this case depicted. It didn't say to me, don't use them, but it certainly created a kind of pause in my capacity to even speak to what was going on in the photo. But that was a kind of upper order, first order engagement with my work that certainly to this day reminds me that every time I show a picture or every time I speak about an incident that involves death, which is the great majority of my work, it's always somebody's death.
This story, and it's true of all these stories, is not really about Professor Zelizer nor about this woman. This story sketches an interface between a researcher and her community, a model for the writing I think we should aspire to. Professor Zelizer says these stories are at the heart of the kind of work she aims for.
I don't gravitate toward, you know, theoretical formulations that don't have some kind of real ground, but the real ground is inhabited and cared about and nurtured and challenged by, you know, the guy who sells me eggs, okay, by the guy who delivers my newspaper. And at some level, the pitch to them is almost more important than the pitch to the academy, because the pitch to the academy is how we've been educated, we've been schooled, we've been trained to think. And I think that the danger of that is that you lose the real life relevance. And in our discipline, I don't think anything should be purely theoretical, quite honestly.
Maybe then it makes sense that our research has these interesting afterlives that we don't always know about. Maybe that's exactly the point.
And so I think the fact that our words don't end when we write them is exactly metaphorical for that, because what it says is that the words go into the environment, they go into the stratosphere, they go into our consciousness, they become part of our memory, our collective memory of how things actually come to mean. And they transform, which is as they should. And I think that, you know, it's a question for me. All of these instances, I think, are reminders, you know, that I'm a small cog in a much larger machine. And I don't mean that in an industrial fashion. I mean it in a creative fashion. I can't do what I do if other people aren't doing what they do, if other people aren't running interpretively in their imagination, you know, in the ways with the impulses that make them, that make my words make sense for them. And so I think at some level, this is exactly as it should be.
Special thanks to Kevin Godkin and Barbie Zelizer. See you next time.
The views expressed on this podcast are those of its producers and do not represent the Annenberg School for Communication, its faculty, staff, or student body. The 3620 podcast is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike International 3.0 license. That means you can remix, repost, or recycle any of the content as long as you aren't making money, you don't change the credits, and you share it under the same license.